words. She was one of the most decorated fighter pilots in the Middle East. How does that stack up against your experience, Sonny? I don't see you in the captain's seat. Jason bridled instantly at his words. Yeah, I know who she is. I saw her husband get his head cut off on TV. What Jason said squeezed Helen's heart like a vice and took her breath away. Nothing showed in her expression, but both men could sense how shocked she was. Jason had hit her hard and done it intentionally, which Connor thought was despicable. He could see tears in Helen's eyes. "I think that's enough of that for today," she said, wanting to stop the exchange between the two men before it got out of hand. Despite the words, which hurt her personally, she was the senior officer and in command here, and both men fell silent. Nancy knocked and was buzzed into the cockpit then, with Joel right behind her, carrying their breakfast trays. The cockpit door closed and locked automatically behind them after they walked in. They always served the pilots first, and the stewards in business class took care of them. The first-class flight attendants were always too busy, providing additional service to their passengers, although they helped out occasionally. And premium economy and coach had their hands full by sheer numbers. The flight crew had omelets, fruit salad, warm biscuits, and an assortment of breakfast pastries on their trays. There was no conversation in the cockpit, after what Jason had said, as Joel and Nancy set down their trays. "Call us when you want to get rid of the trays," Nancy said pleasantly, as Jason eyed her again and she ignored him. He acted as though any woman on the planet would be lucky to sleep with him. She had more important things on her mind after the positive pregnancy test that morning. She could hardly wait to see her husband and tell him. She and Helen exchanged a warm look of female solidarity, and both Nancy and Joel noticed that the other captain looked angry about something. "Wow," Joel whispered as the cockpit door closed and locked behind them again. "You can cut the atmosphere in there with a knife today. That's the only thing I hate about our job," he said as they walked back into the galley in business class. "You never know how the chemistry is going to work out. I love flying with new people all the time, but when you get a lemon, it can sure turn your day to shit in a hurry." They both laughed at what he said. "And the flight deck does not look like fun today," he added as he started putting the garnish on the trays. They were offering three choices of breakfast to the passengers, which kept them busy working the ovens to heat the biscuits and the quiche they were serving. They also had scrambled eggs with sausages, smoked salmon and bagels, and oatmeal with fruit salad. They served a hearty breakfast on the early flight. With the time difference in their favor flying west, the passengers had a long day ahead of them, many of them with meetings to attend for the rest of the day, as soon as they arrived. Joel and Nancy headed down the aisle with the cart loaded up with trays a few minutes later. They had handed out headphones for the entertainment system immediately after takeoff, and several people were already watching movies, including the two unaccompanied children, Nicole and Mark, who had been upgraded and had been no trouble so far. Nicole was adorable, and Mark took good care of her. Other passengers were working on their computers, getting ready for work, or keeping up with what was happening in their offices in New York by email. People who took the early flight were rarely demanding, which was why Nancy liked it. By the end of the day, passengers were tired, cranky, and stressed by whatever had gone wrong in their day and took it out on the flight attendants. They were more likely to wind up with delayed flights and often drank too much. Everyone was still fresh and in a better mood in the morning. Catherine James was awake again by then, after her heavy dose of champagne before takeoff, and was working on her computer, as was the man sitting next to her. The couple across the aisle were conferring quietly, although he still didn't look happy. He took vegetarian quiche, and his female companion smiled at Nancy, as though in collusion with her and silently apologizing for her somewhat grumpy husband. Nancy mentioned to Joel how serious and unsmiling he was compared to his very friendly wife, who seemed open and happy and excited about the trip and their upgrade. "He didn't seem to approve when I offered them earphones," Joel added, "and he wouldn't let the woman take them. He told her not to in Arabic, I think. I'm sure they're fine, but I assume someone checked them against the no-fly list before they boarded, he said, and Nancy reassured him. Neither the crew nor the public knew exactly how the no-fly list worked, only that there was one that listed anyone suspected of terrorist ties or activities, and that Homeland Security was diligent about their job. I don't think he's a terrorist. He's just a crabby guy. She seems very sweet, though. She smiled at Joel. In the course of their work, they had occasionally seen passengers refused entry to the plane, or removed before a flight took off, if their names were on any of the sensitive lists. And they knew that there was an armed air marshal somewhere on the plane, usually in first class, sometimes with a second one elsewhere on the flight. Some were harder to detect than others, and no one was supposed to be able to recognize them. They were on board to protect the passengers and crew, in case someone got violent or tried to take over the plane. There was a rumor that they were cutting back on air marshals, but the crew doubted that it was true. There had been air marshals on the flights as long as they'd both been flying, and it was comforting to know. The woman in 2C looked like she was going to have a heart attack when that couple boarded. Joel commented, meaning Catherine James. "You mean the champagne guzzler?" Nancy said, and both laughed. "She looks sober now." Nancy defended her. They had a lot of passengers who used alcohol to calm their nerves, even on morning flights. It always amazed Nancy how they could drink at such an early hour. Joel cleaned up the galley, while Nancy picked up the trays one by one and brought them back. She offered coloring books with crayons to the two unaccompanied children, but only Nicole took one. Her brother Mark was engrossed in watching a movie, the latest Disney film about dragons, and they both looked happy. Joel served another round of coffee in the cockpit, and the atmosphere had eased up a little after breakfast. The captain was quiet, and Jason was complaining about the airline when Connor let Joel in. Jason was grousing about how high-handed management was with younger pilots, and kept them in the co-pilot seat forever. "You have to earn your position here," Connor was saying coldly, as Joel poured his coffee, and the retired captain smiled up at him and nodded. "You can't expect to just walk in and take over." "I'll bet she did," Jason said, nodding toward Helen. "I had a lot more flying hours than most people because of the Air Force," Helen said modestly, not wanting to make an issue of it, or get into an argument with her co-pilot. "I flew in your seat for a long time. You've got years ahead of you. I'm sure you'll be in the captain's seat soon," Connor said to Jason. He wanted to add, "if you clean up your attitude and stop shooting your mouth off." But he didn't. He knew better. The handsome young pilot was a hothead, and Connor was sure he'd been just as brash with top management, which hadn't done him any good. They wanted to see pilots who were calm and in control, could face any situation, both mechanical or with passengers and crew, and maintain a level head. Jason Andrews didn't fit that description, and had a lot to learn about how to treat people and behave with his superiors. Part of his problem was that he was young and felt entitled. It was an attitude and a generation of pilots Connor didn't like. Helen was much more the profile of who the airline wanted in the pilot seat, whatever her sex. She looked like nothing would upset her. Jason's mention of her husband's murder on worldwide media had been an intentional heavy blow below the belt to upset her gratuitously, but she had handled it with grace. She was watching conditions and checking dials, even though the aircraft was on autopilot. She was ever vigilant, but the weather conditions were perfect an hour into the flight and were expected to stay that way. Connor left the cockpit then and stopped to chat for a minute with the flight attendants. He said hello to both women in the first-class cabin and then chatted with Nancy and Joel in the galley and business, and they smiled when they saw the retired captain. They'd been talking about Susan Farrow, the actress, being on the flight in first. The purser had confirmed that she was on board before takeoff, and Jennifer had come back for a minute to visit them, and said the famous movie star was a remarkably nice, unassuming person, and was traveling with a little dog she had registered with the airline as an emotional support animal, so she could keep it in her seat with her. When he heard them, Connor said he had met her once when she was on one of his flights, and she had been a beautiful woman then, and extremely gracious. "She still looks pretty good," She must be at least 70 by now, Joel volunteered. I've seen every movie she's ever been in. She had won 3 Academy Awards in the course of an extraordinary career. I think she's been married 3 or 4 times. I think her last husband died last year. She was married to a famous director. He directed her in her last movie. He was already sick and died right after that. I read about it in People, he said, looking mildly embarrassed to be gossiping about her, and for an instant, Connor Gray seemed sad again. And then he went to the restroom and afterward nodded at them and headed back to the cockpit. They said management retired him in New York, Nancy whispered to Joel after he had left. I don't know what happened, but it must have been something serious. The poor guy looks very down about something. A friend of mine was on the flight, Nancy added. I don't know all the details. I think he had a heart attack or something after they landed, or maybe a stroke. It was supposedly minor, but the next thing I heard was that they retired him. I think he was only a year or two away from retirement anyway, but whatever it was, he can't fly anymore. That must be tough for a guy like him, to have them force him into retirement from one day to the next, with no time to prepare for it or adjust. This is their whole life, but you can't have pilots whose health puts everyone at risk, she said sensibly, and Joel didn't disagree, although he felt sorry for him. Mentally and physically, Joel added, which was obvious, and justified the rigorous psychological and physical testing the flight crews underwent every year, and no one objected to. On the contrary, it was reassuring to know that the airline standards were kept high to reduce the chance of any problems or even disasters that could occur while in the air. He's a good guy. I've heard great things about him over the years. I like Helen Smith, Nancy commented. She's got a fantastic flying record. I don't know how she survived what happened to her husband. I would be a basket case after that, Nancy added sympathetically. How do you live through seeing your husband beheaded on TV? Bad enough to lose him in those circumstances, but to see it. It brought tears to her eyes thinking about it, and Joel nodded. It had been gruesome, and the United States had objected vigorously and retaliated on the ground. She must have kids, too, but she looks sane in spite of everything. And she seems very personable. She's pretty quiet. You never know how things like that affect people. It's hard for the rest of us to imagine. I'm sure she's had a lot of counseling to help her get past it, Joel said quietly. I don't think you ever do get past it, Nancy said sadly, thinking about Helen's husband. How could you? She doesn't seem like an angry person, though. A little sad, maybe, or introverted. A lot of pilots are like that, Joel said. Some of them aren't big talkers. And then you get the chatty Cathys, who schmooze their way through the whole flight and drive everyone nuts on the PA system. Or our charming co-pilot today. I hate to say it, but he seems like an asshole. He's so full of himself. He's nice looking, but no one is hot enough to get away with that. He's a racist, and I can tell he's homophobic. I was beaten up by guys like him in Utah when I was a kid. That's why I moved to San Francisco as soon as I got out of college. My parents made me go to BYU, Brigham Young University, and after that I got the hell out of Dodge. I left 2 weeks after graduation. My parents weren't happy about it, but I couldn't take it anymore. I have a brother who's gay and still lives there. He's totally in the closet and tells everyone he has a girlfriend. His girlfriend's name is Henry, Joel said. It makes me sad for him every time I hear him lie about it. That's no way to live. And then he decided to share his good news with her, although he didn't know her well. But he was too happy and excited to keep his secret and was desperate to share it. My partner and I are getting married on Friday. He beamed after he said it, and Nancy congratulated him. I had some good news today myself, she said, smiling too, but didn't say what it was. Sounds like this is our lucky day, she said. Then Joel laughed. Mine will be on Friday. We've been together for 2 years, and he's the nicest man in the world. I met him on a flight to Miami I switched for, to do a friend a favor, who wanted my Boston flight to see her boyfriend, and I got a husband out of it. Good trade for me. They were still talking when Bobby, one of the flight attendants from coach, showed up during her break with a harried expression. She was young and full of energy, but she looked stressed as she joined them. "We've got a girls' chorus of 14 girls, and they're running all over the place, with a chaperone who's driving us nuts and letting them do whatever they want. We've got a guy with a baby that hasn't stopped screaming since we took off, and one of our toilets just broke. You people have the good life up here. I'm not signing up for coach again." They laughed at her description of it, and had all been there, too. It was luck of the draw as to where they got assigned, but they all agreed that business class was their preference. There were too many entitled people in first who demanded constant attention, and the meals were more elaborate. But coach was a zoo. Business was mostly adults and often business people on a flight like this, except for the two unaccompanied children who had been upgraded but had been easy so far. After venting to them for a few minutes, Bobby went back to Hell Class, as she called it, and Nancy and Joel sat down to chat and read magazines until someone called them. Joel continued talking about his wedding. He was excited to land and see his future husband and leave for their honeymoon in Tahiti. And Nancy was desperate to share her news with her husband. They were both in a good mood and couldn't wait to land in San Francisco in a little less than 5 hours. And the sky was as smooth as silk. No turbulence, no problems. Inside the plane or out. The first flight to San Francisco, the A321, had been in the air for an hour by then, and the 757 for 40 minutes. Bernice felt the postcard of the Golden Gate Bridge burning a hole in her pocket. What if the message was serious or dangerous, and she did nothing about it, and something happened to one of the planes? So many crazy things happened on airplanes these days. Ever since 9/11, you couldn't rule out any possibility, even if it seemed far-fetched. She knew she had to say something, even if they thought she was overly dramatic for her concerns, and there was no point talking to her supervisor about it. She would just blow her off again. Bernice went into an office and picked up the phone. She knew the number to call, and wondered if she'd be reprimanded if she was wrong. But something in her gut told her she had to do it, no matter what the consequences for her. She called for airport security and told them it wasn't a full-on alert of a bomb threat or an abandoned suitcase, but she had found something in an X-ray bin that concerned her, and she thought someone on the security team should come and see it, for risk assessment. Maybe they would think she was ridiculous, but at least then she would have done what she could, and maybe it was nothing after all. But she also knew that if the airport security team was worried about it too, all hell was about to break loose, and she had started it. The postcard was in her pocket, and she was shaking while she waited for them to show up. She told no one she had called them, not even Della. Bernice hoped she was just being cautious, but her instincts had been right before, about people carrying drugs, and once the components for a bomb. It had been a college kid who wanted to see if he could get away with it, but had gotten 3 years in prison nonetheless. And she had received a citation and mention on her record from Homeland Security. But this felt different. Even though she realized it could be absolutely nothing, she didn't want to take the chance of staying quiet about it. And if she was wrong, she'd accept responsibility for her mistake and endure Denise's ridicule for sure. It might even jeopardize her job, but she felt she had no choice. She had people's lives in her hands. Bernice had never hesitated to act on what she believed in and stand up for what she thought was right. She wondered how long it would take security to show up and talk to her. Her stomach was in a knot as she waited. It felt like it was taking them forever. Her heart was pounding in her chest, her palms were sweaty, and her uniform was damp under the arms. She felt like something bad was about to happen, and all she could do was pray that she was wrong. Chapter 4. When Bernice called the Office of Airport Security, a secretary took the call and jotted down what she said, that it was not a bomb threat, but something suspicious had been found in an X-ray bin. It wasn't a high priority, the way she had described it, but they had to check it out if a TSA agent called it in. The secretary walked into David Lee's office and handed him the slip of paper. He groaned when he saw her coming, and took the note from her hand reluctantly. He knew he couldn't dodge it, but he'd had a busy morning. Two Indonesian men had been caught with more money than they were allowed to bring in. He had been called, but turned it over to Homeland Security immediately for them to deal with. A college student was caught selling marijuana and cocaine in one of the restrooms. A passenger had reported her, and he had called in the Port Authority police and had to fill out a report. An abandoned rolling bag had turned up in Terminal 4, and he had called the bomb squad to handle it. They x-rayed it before taking it away to blow it up, and it was filled with pharmaceutical samples and a box of condoms. Some tired salesman had forgotten his samples, and they sent it to Lost and Found. Dave just wanted 5 minutes to himself for a cup of coffee before the next round, but he could see that wasn't going to happen. He tried to address each situation as quickly as he could, and rarely got a break during the day. Even if some of the reports sounded ridiculous, they had to check out every call that came in, and if there was merit to it, he had to call the right authorities to handle it. His job was one of constant triage. He had wanted to be a chemical engineer, and his brother was a nuclear scientist. His parents were from mainland China, and he had been born in the States, and they still didn't understand what he did at the airport, and sometimes neither did he. He had taken a summer job he thought would be fun and exciting, and 10 years later, he was still there as a senior security officer. Some days he loved what he did, and felt useful to humanity. Other days he hated it, and it felt like a bad joke or a reality show. Once he'd been called in for a pet alligator a man had smuggled in a carrying case, claiming it was a dog. A flight attendant had spotted it before takeoff. "Is this Bernice Adams a supervisor?" he asked the secretary. Not that it made a difference. He would have to go either way. But the suspicious report was more likely to be a real one from a supervisor, although he knew from experience that wasn't always the case. He had seen damn near every imaginable situation in 10 years at JFK. He had even delivered twins in an airport bathroom for a woman who claimed she didn't know she was 8 months pregnant, and the paramedics took too long to get there after he called them. The mother and twins had done fine, and she named one of them after him. But he hoped he never had to do that again. "She said she wasn't," the secretary answered. There were three of them who took the calls as they came in and relayed the messages to the next available security officer on duty. And Dave was the next one up. "What she got?" He looked puzzled by the message. "Something suspicious in the X-ray bin, but not a bomb." "That's good news, at least." He grabbed his jacket off the back of his chair and left his office. It was a short drive to the terminal where Bernice was working. He asked for her by name when he got there. They had gotten busier again. The lines of departing passengers were long, and he asked one of the supervisors to point her out, which he did. A passenger was arguing with Bernice about what he claimed was a service dog, but he had no paperwork to prove it. The dog was huge and looked like a pit bull, and the passenger wanted the dog in the cabin with him, unconfined. Denise overheard Dave Lee question one of the male supervisors about Bernice and asked him about it. "What's that about? What's airport security doing here?" "I don't know. Bernice must have called them," her colleague said, unconcerned. "Maybe about the dog. That dog looks like he could take someone's arm off." The other passengers standing near it were looking nervous, and the dog had started to growl and bare its fangs. Its owner wouldn't relent on wanting to take it with him, and not putting it in the cargo hold in a crate, and was using every argument to support his position. Bernice was happy to be removed from the situation when Dave Lee approached her and introduced himself to her. "Thank you for that," she said softly, as they walked away from dog and owner and left it to one of the supervisors. "Looks like you're having a fun day," he said easily, and she laughed. "Yeah, I got bitten by a chihuahua some woman asked me to hold last week. I didn't think they had teeth." He smiled, and she followed him into an empty supervisor's office, and he got right to the point. "So what do you have? What did you find in the bin?" She seemed alert and intelligent and looked hesitant for a minute, and felt stupid now that he was here. Did you tell your supervisor about it? She nodded. And? She thinks I'm crazy, and I might be. I've just got a weird feeling about this. It's been bugging me since I found it this morning. She pulled the postcard out of her pocket and handed it to him. That's it? A postcard? He looked startled. She seemed smarter than that, and more sensible than to get worked up over a postcard, unless it had a threat written on the back. He flipped it over, and it didn't. Just the message Bernice had read when she first saw it. I don't know, Bernice said apologetically. The message seemed aggressive to me, especially with forever underlined like that, and the picture of the bridge. If it had flowers on it or something, or hearts, but the bridge and that message looked weird to me. He thought about it for a long moment, staring at it as though something additional would appear if they looked at it long enough, but nothing did. And then he looked back at Bernice. I see what you mean. It would seem romantic or sexual to me, or something in that vein. But I can see how the image and the message could seem threatening to you. What does your gut tell you? He asked her, narrowing his eyes as he looked at her, trying to evaluate her as much as the message. Being able to assess people and guess right was the most important part of his job, and he was good at it. I don't know why, she said honestly, but it doesn't feel right to me. I kept wanting to throw it away, but I couldn't. Something kept stopping me. She knew she probably sounded like a nut job to him, but it was true. How long have you worked here?
5 years.
I've caught a couple of drug dealers going through, but I've never felt like this before about something I found in a bin. We find all kinds of things. Jewelry, money, cell phones, a handgun once. I know this is just a postcard, and I'm probably wrong, but it scared me. What if someone is targeting the bridge? He nodded. The same thought had occurred to him, even though it sounded like a long shot to him, too. But who would have believed that 9/11 could happen before it did? That had been a wake-up call to anyone in security. They couldn't take anything for granted ever since. When did you find it?
We had 2 San Francisco flights this morning at 8 a.m. It was right around then, just before or after they took off. They canceled an A380, and I was told they accommodated all the passengers by breaking it into 2 flights, with equipment they had on the ground.
He nodded. So they had at least 2 flights to check out, if he decided to pursue this, which would be twice the complications and twice the work, to figure out which flight the danger was on, if there was any at all. Or it could be a wild goose chase, and just a postcard with a message that meant nothing. He sat staring at the card in his hand, as though he were psychic and expected to know if the potential danger was bogus or not. The postcard of the Golden Gate Bridge seemed to link the possibility to the 2 flights heading to San Francisco. If you want to know what I think, he said to Bernice, as though they were partners in this and had discovered it together. I think it's probably nothing. Maybe a guy who proposed to some girl on the bridge got turned down and is saying she'll regret it. Or someone who's never been to San Francisco and was flying to St. Louis this morning. You can never tell about these things. Most of what we get like this is totally random. You have to be a mind reader to figure it out. And you never know what really happened, and nothing comes of it. There's a 99.999999% chance this is just a postcard. But there's that tiny fraction of a percent that says it could be something. That's what's talking to your gut, and what I work with. I think we're probably both off base, but it's my job not to ignore stuff like this. I don't want the responsibility of deciding it's nothing, and find out I'm wrong when the bridge blows sky high. Chances are that won't happen. But if it does, you and I will know that we could have made a difference. I'm going to call the main office of Homeland Security and hand this baby off to them. If they decide it's nothing, then you and I are off the hook. I can't make this decision without them, or, let's say, I don't want to. As he said it, and Bernice nodded seriously, listening to him, wondering if she had started a tempest in a teapot, Denise walked in and scowled at Bernice ferociously. What trouble are you causing? She accused Bernice as Dave Lee watched her, intrigued by the dynamic.
She obviously didn't like the agent who had called him, and he wondered why. The senior TSA officer exuded disapproval and contempt for the younger, prettier woman. But Bernice seemed smart and efficient to him. Maybe that was the problem. And he didn't think she'd been wrong to call him. In his opinion, she had done absolutely the right thing, following her instincts. "Are you Miss Adams's supervisor?" he asked Denise, with a serious expression.
"I am,"
she said reluctantly.
"What's going on here?"
"Dave Lee, senior officer, airport security," he introduced himself. "It's about the postcard she found. I think she told you about it." Denise looked frightened for a minute, afraid that she was in trouble. This was beginning to sound official, although she thought Bernice was stupid to call them, and she was furious she hadn't asked her first. She wouldn't have let her, and Bernice knew it.
"I have the same concerns she did," Dave said. "I'm almost positive it's nothing, and so is she. But I'm not willing to stake my life on it or anyone else's. I'm calling in the main office of Homeland Security. We can let them figure it out. If they don't want to pursue it, that's their business."
He picked up the desk phone, as he said it, and dialed a number. He told whoever he spoke to where he was and what was happening, and then listened to them and hung up a minute later. He looked at both women. "They'll be here in 20 minutes. I'm going to get a cup of coffee. I'll be back before they get here." And without saying another word, he left them then, as Denise looked at Bernice in a fury and waited till he was out of earshot before she said anything.
"You realize, don't you, you're going to be in a world of trouble if you stirred up all this shit for nothing?"
"I know," Bernice said meekly. She had been thinking that herself, and had called security anyway.
"You'll be lucky if you don't lose your job over this," Denise said angrily. And she realized that she herself looked bad, because she had not acted on Bernice's concerns.
If Bernice turned out to be right to be worried, it was Denise's ass that was going to be on the line, not hers.
"I understand that, but I couldn't ignore it, Denise. I don't know if there's anything to it or not, but I couldn't take the chance that it might be real."
"You better pray that it is, girl, or you're going to be 10 feet under a pile of shit."
All Bernice could think as Denise threatened her was that she only had 2 more months of law school to finish, and she could apply for a job as a paralegal if nothing else. But there was no way she could ignore a possible risk of some kind of terrorist threat, assuming the worst case was about the postcard, which seemed unlikely. But you just never knew, as Dave Lee had said himself. Denise walked out of the office then, and Bernice followed her, torn between feeling worried about her job and about the postcard, and the possible danger it represented if it was a terrorist threat of some kind, however far-fetched that seemed. Homeland Security would have to make that decision. She didn't have the authority to do that at TSA. Even Dave Lee felt he couldn't, with all the experience he had. It validated Bernice's concerns somewhat, as Della came up to her and whispered,
"What's happening? Someone said that airport security was here to see you, and Denise said Homeland Security is showing up, and boy, is she pissed."
"I know she is. I found something in a bin this morning. It's probably nothing." She tried to tone it down for Della, until they knew more.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
Della looked surprised that she hadn't. They told each other everything at work. Or so she'd thought.
"I thought I was just being paranoid.
I told Denise and she blew it off, which is probably why she's so pissed now. It kept bothering me, so I called AS without telling her, and the AS guy decided to call the main Homeland Security guys to check it out. They're probably going to decide I'm nuts and have me fired, or at least that's what Denise said."
"Screw her. It sounds like you did the right thing, if they called Homeland Security. Is it some kind of threat?"
"Could be," Bernice said vaguely. She didn't want to tell Della before Homeland Security made a decision about it.
"Keep me posted,"
Della said and went back to the spot where she was working, directing people into the body scan machine. Bernice was on a break now, and Homeland Security was due any minute, so there was no point going back to work yet. She stood there waiting, while Denise ignored her, and prayed that it would all turn out to be nothing. She didn't want anyone to get hurt, even if she lost her job. She could hardly wait to leave anyway when she graduated. She'd had enough of Denise's abuse. It was time to move on. Her 5 years at TSA had served her well. They had given her the time she needed to go to law school, and a salary she could live on and support her son with while she was doing it. But she didn't want to put up with Denise or anyone like her anymore. Thinking about it made her feel braver as she waited for Homeland Security to arrive. Ben Waterman sat at his desk after his third cup of coffee, feeling slightly jangled. But his nerves were on edge these days anyway. It was his first day back at work after a month's leave. The highly publicized hostage situation that had gone sour a month before in an airport warehouse had left 16 people dead when a SWAT team rushed in to rescue the hostages after a 24-hour siege, and the hostage takers had killed them all, including a child in the final shootout, and then killed themselves before they could be captured. The decision to go in had been made by the captain of the SWAT team, in conjunction with the police and the head of Homeland Security. But Ben had been part of the decision, and urged strongly for it. The hostage takers were starting to panic. Ben could feel it, and he was sure innocent people would be killed, so he had fought for the SWAT team to take action. And in the end, they had all died anyway. No one blamed him for it, and from everything they knew now, it had been a no-win situation. The perpetrators were seeking worldwide attention for an extremist cause, and his superiors had told him afterward that there probably had been no way to spare the hostages right from the beginning. But it was no consolation, with 16 people dead. In spite of a month of intense therapy and debriefing, Ben blamed himself for his part in the decision, and knew he always would. How did you forgive yourself for the blood of 16 people on your hands? How could you ever know or believe that there had been no right decision? What if there was, and he had missed it? He had been among the first on the scene after everyone had died, and it had been carnage. They'd almost had to drag him away. He had done everything he could to save them and keep them alive. They had given him permission to take up to 3 months off, or longer if he needed it, but he was back in a month. Staying home was worse. It was all he thought about, the terrible scene when they had gone in after the final shootout. Ben had sobbed when he saw them, and now he was back, feeling a little shaky but anxious to work. He had been at his desk for exactly an hour and a half when Dave Lee called him and said they had a possible situation at Terminal 2. The last thing he needed right now was a situation. He had come back to handle customs issues, people who didn't declare large amounts of money they were bringing into the country, jewelry some socialite hadn't declared for duty, even drugs being smuggled. The easy stuff. He didn't want to have to make any big decisions. And Dave Lee had said to him that they needed a decision about a possible situation. He wanted to hang up on him when he heard it. Dave had said it was time-sensitive and involved two flights that were in the air at that moment, heading to San Francisco. So there was no time to waste. But Ben felt rooted to the spot and didn't want to move as he sat at his desk, wondering who he could reassign it to so he wouldn't have to go. Ben was 45 years old and had had an impeccable career until the recent incident, and his superiors were sure that he would recover from it. They were more certain of it than Ben was himself. He felt as though there would never come a time when he would wake up in the morning and not think of what he'd seen in the warehouse that day. He saw it in his mind's eye when he went to sleep at night and when he woke up in the morning. He had told the shrink about it, and the therapist had said it would get better, which seemed hard for Ben to believe. It was as sharply etched in his mind as it had been the day it happened. He was thinking about it again when Phil Carson, his boss, walked into his office. "I just got a call from the chief supervisor of airport security," he said with a serious expression. "Apparently, they called you to assess a situation. Are you okay with that?" Ben wanted to tell him that he wasn't, not by any means, but he was back, and he didn't want to tell him he wasn't up to it. And then there were all the bullshit beliefs about getting back in the saddle. Homeland Security was not a job for the faint-hearted, or agents who couldn't recover from seeing 16 people dead on a warehouse floor after a shootout, especially if the decision to go in had been in great part their fault. It went with the territory, and he had to live with it if he wanted to keep his job. This was how it started, with a situation and a decision you would be responsible for, whether people died or not.
"Yeah, I'll do it," Ben said, standing up slowly.
"Though if we've got someone else to send, I'd prefer it," he said honestly.
"Who've we got?"
"I don't have anyone today.
Harkness broke his ankle last week. Thompson and O'Doherty are out with the flu, and Jimenez is on his honeymoon again. He's got to give that up. He can't afford the alimony, and we can't afford the vacation. So that leaves you," his commanding officer said, looking worried. He knew that Ben was still badly shaken by what had happened, and he had come back to work sooner than Phil expected.
"Doesn't sound like a big deal. You can check the manifest if they're worried about a passenger, and make sure that no one on the no-fly list is on it.
Call me if you have a problem," he said, looking sympathetic. Ben was one of his best men, and he didn't want to lose him, or kill him by putting too much on his shoulders on his first day back. And then he had a thought just as Ben was about to leave the office.
"Take Amanda with you. If it's not too dicey, you can let her handle it. It'll make her feel good."
Ben groaned audibly. Amanda Albright was the latest addition to their team. She was 31 years old and had a double master's in psychology and criminology, both of which were worthless, as far as Ben was concerned. She had a theory for everything, and none of it had any reality to it. She never stopped talking, and she was the new breed of Homeland Security agent, whose entire philosophy went against everything Ben believed. He could barely say good morning to her without getting seriously irritated.
"Now I know you hate me," Ben said, looking miserable.
"Does she have to come with me?" He looked like a kid who didn't want to take his medicine, or his little brother to a ball game.
"She'll be good for comic relief. Just try to bring her back in one piece. Don't kill her. I don't want to be visiting you in jail."
Amanda liked to believe she was a dedicated feminist, but as far as Ben was concerned, she was a pain in the ass, whatever her gender, and her theories drove him up the wall.
"You might have to. I've been cleared to return to duty, not to work with her. I'd need another year of therapy for that."
"Just don't listen to her. Talk to her about baseball or sports or something. If I have to listen to her tell me about her Stanford and Columbia credentials again, I may have to strangle her."
"Be nice. Tell her about the Yankees."
Ben grinned ruefully and went to find her. He didn't like anything about her, although as a rule he liked women. He had been married and divorced twice and had no kids. Both his wives had said that his passion for his work and the amount of time he spent on it were not compatible with marriage, and he agreed. He dated women his own age when he found any that interested him, which wasn't often. He didn't like frivolous women or know-it-alls, which was Amanda's stock in trade. Just talking to her annoyed him. She was young and sexy, and wore skirts that barely covered her ass, but nothing about her appealed to him. Least of all her endless theories about criminals and crime. She had no experience to back up what she said, just what she had learned in books, and Ben and most of the guys in the office thought she was full of shit and didn't like her. She didn't like them either. She thought they were a crusty bunch of older guys who told disgusting jokes, and she threatened to write them up for sexual harassment and discrimination regularly. Ben admitted that she was probably right, but it didn't make him like her any better. And none of the men were going to change. She was chasing a lost cause. She was at her desk, filling out a report. She had handled a drug bust the day before. She was competent and overeducated. In the field, she was considered green by the men she worked with. Amanda looked up when Ben walked in, and didn't smile. She felt sorry about what had happened to him, but their overt hostility toward each other made it hard for her to express her sympathy.
"How are you feeling?" she asked him. "Welcome back."
"Thanks. I have nightmares," he said, mostly to provoke her. Phil wants you to go to Terminal 2 with me.
And you don't, she challenged him.
I didn't say that.
He didn't have to.
They both knew he didn't.
What's up at Terminal 2?
She asked as she stood up.
She was going with him. She just needed to give him a hard time about it, as he saw it. She always wanted to know the details of everything, to an unnecessary degree, in his opinion. Most of what she wanted to know was irrelevant to anyone but her. But her question had been reasonable in the context. He just wouldn't have admitted it to her.
I don't know. They said it's not a threat. They need a decision about something. We'll find out when we get there.
She followed him out in what Ben considered a shockingly short skirt. He was more than willing to admit she had great legs, but her personality ruined it for him. He didn't care what she looked like. He hated everything she stood for. But on the way over, he decided to take Phil's advice.
Do you like baseball?
She looked at him like he had lost his mind.
No. Why?
The Yankees are on a winning streak, he said benignly, trying not to laugh.
Maybe Phil was right.
I thought you might be interested.
Are you asking me on a date?
She looked stunned. Maybe he'd had electroshock therapy as part of his recovery. She thought he'd have to ask her out.
Shit, no. I just wondered if you liked sports.
I just don't like baseball. It's boring. I played volleyball in college. We won the championship 2 years in a row. I play badminton and tennis. And I go to a gym to stay in shape. What about you?
It was a ridiculous conversation, but they were at Terminal 2 by then and hadn't gotten into an argument yet, which was a first.
I lift weights in my living room now that my wife moved out. I'm a black belt in karate, but I quit the last time I broke my shoulder. And I played beer pong in college, he said smugly.
So did I, she said,
always competitive with him and any of her male colleagues.
You would,
he said, as they got out of the car and walked into the terminal.
Dave Lee was waiting for them, and Ben introduced Amanda. Something about the way he did it conveyed the impression that they weren't friends, and Dave walked them into the chief supervisor's office in the TSA area, where Bernice was standing. Neither Ben nor Amanda was wearing a uniform. The TSA agents did, but the senior Homeland Security agents wore street clothes, if they chose to. Dave showed them the postcard. Ben looked at it for a long moment, and then back at Dave.
And the question is...
The question is, what is it? A big nothing? Something between lovers? It sounds faintly pissed off to me, and maybe a little menacing. Or is it a threat on the Golden Gate Bridge?
Ben whistled and looked at it again, narrowing his eyes. That's pretty unlikely, don't you think?
Could be. Nowadays, who the hell knows? We've all seen worse, with less to go on.
They all knew it was true, and sometimes they got no warning. This wasn't much of a warning. But was it a clue? That was the crux of the issue. Did the postcard mean anything or not?
What have you got in the air right now?
Ben asked him.
Flights all over the country, and two to San Francisco that left an hour and a half ago, about 15 minutes apart, an A321 and a 757.
And you've checked the manifest for both flights?
Ben asked seriously.
I assume someone ran them against the no-fly list before they took off,
Dave said calmly. I only got called after they were in the air.
They were both aware that the no-fly list was compiled by Homeland Security and the CIA, with highly sensitive information provided by international government agencies listing people known or suspected of terrorist activities, or who were undesirable in the United States. Its purpose was to keep dangerous, subversive people out of the country and off planes. There was a well-known case of an Air France flight with two suspected terrorists on board who had turned up on the sensitive lists. The plane had been kept sealed on arrival. No passengers were allowed to disembark, and the flight was refueled and sent back to Paris.
Let's run the manifests again and see what comes up. Who's on both those flights?
We need a psychological profile of everyone, both passengers and crew, Amanda piped up, and Ben turned to look at her, trying to control himself.
That would be a great idea if they were on a cruise ship in the Caribbean. We have 4.5 hours to figure this out, at best. Maybe add another 15 minutes, or have them circle for 30 minutes. We can get profiles on the crew and key passengers. There's no way we can get them on everyone on those 2 planes. Ben turned back to Dave again then. Let's get those profiles on the crew, and make sure we don't have some seriously disturbed employee up there that we don't know about. And I'll have them run the no-fly list again, and check for any passenger that stands out. I'll get my office to take care of it. We can get that pretty fast. Ben called his office then, and told them what he needed. And Ben, Dave, and Amanda sat down to wait. The answers started coming in quickly. Bernice listened closely to what was happening, but hadn't said a word. She had nothing to add. Amanda asked her a few questions about how long she'd worked here, and her seniority. And then Dave got the manifest by email on his phone, and shared it with Ben and Amanda. She spotted Susan Farrow's name and was impressed. Well, she's not our problem, Ben commented. They could see no one of interest on the manifest of the second flight. And then Ben saw the Arab last name on the manifest of the first flight, which attracted his attention but didn't concern him unduly. I assume they were checked out on the no-fly list, he said to Dave. We check everyone, he confirmed. There could have been a slip-up, but I doubt it. I'm sure we checked, too, Ben said quietly. I'll run it again. Our office can tell us in a few minutes. Dave nodded in response, looking serious. And I'm assuming we've got air marshals on both flights, Ben said, looking thoughtful, and called Phil to check it out. There was a pause at the other end of the line when he asked, which surprised him, and Phil sighed. We had a problem while you were gone. Apparently, someone ordered cutbacks without warning us. Some flights have been going out without marshals, and the pilots weren't notified. Everyone is pissed about it, but we have not had 100% coverage in the air for the past month. I'll check on both these flights. But with the flight split into 2 aircrafts at the last minute, it's possible that we've only got 1 guy up there. I hope not, but it's possible. I'll call you back. He called back less than 5 minutes later and gave Ben the bad news. We've got one on the second flight, but the A321 has no air marshal on board. The pilot has not been advised. For Christ's sake, are they serious? Ben was furious at the idea, particularly in this case. That's the reality of it. There's no marshal on that flight, and we checked the couple with the Arabic surnames. They're not on the no-fly list, but we don't know who they are. They could be perfectly innocent, or we could have a problem. Well, find out, for Christ's sake. Phil was used to Ben's style, and he always brought home the results. He didn't object to Ben being cantankerous and even rough at times, particularly after what he'd been through. Do you really think we have a problem? Phil sounded worried, but Ben hadn't decided. He needed to know more. I don't know yet. We need the crew profiles on both flights, and I want everything we can get on the 2 Arabs, just in case. Ben was livid that there was no air marshal on the flight. The only names that had caught their attention on the 2 manifests were the Arab man and woman, who could be anybody, and Susan Farrow, the famous actress, who was not a terrorist. Phil was going to call his source at the CIA to check on the 2 Arabs. Ben sat back with a sigh and looked at the others in the room. What we have here is basically a cover-your-ass mission, Ben said with a look of displeasure. We don't have a goddamn thing. We have 2 aircraft full of random people, 2 Arabs who are not on the no-fly list and could be harmless or not, and no air marshal on one of the flights. If we put the whole thing to bed and forget about it, and some nut job dive-bombs the Golden Gate Bridge on a suicide mission, we've killed 111 people on the flight and possibly more on the ground, and we get maximum publicity with a major movie star on the flight, just in case we needed that. In my head, I think it's nothing, he said to the others out loud. In my gut, something is bothering me, and I don't know what it is. But just in case, I want to talk to the pilot of the A321 the 2 Arabs are on, so we're covered. I want to let her know she has a potential problem on board, and no air marshal on the plane.
She'll be thrilled with that, Ben said unhappily, and then called Phil again. Have we got SATCOM phones in the cockpit of the A321? He asked him, and Phil said they did, which would allow them a private conversation with the pilot that no one else could hear. He said they'd get the number from the airline in 5 minutes and call him back. As soon as Ben got the number, he called Helen on the flight and explained who he was. She sounded surprised to hear from him and said that everything was fine on the flight. Almost fine, he corrected her. Your air marshal wound up on the other aircraft. You don't have one on your flight. She paused for a moment as she listened to him and decided not to tell the others. His decision to warn her on the SATCOM phone instead of the radio had been a good one. Only she could hear Ben on the phone, so no one needed to know they had no protection. Roger, I got that, she said quietly and didn't comment on it further. A TSA agent found a postcard we're not happy about. It could be nothing. It's not a direct threat, but slightly suspicious, relating to San Francisco. We're going to investigate it further. And you've got two Arabs on the flight the CIA is IDing for us now. They weren't on the no-fly list, and they're probably fine. I just want to check them out, and any passengers who stand out. I'll let you know if we have a problem after that, but I wanted to give you a heads-up about the air marshal. I think it happened when they split the flight, though it shouldn't have. They both knew that, and so did Phil and Dave. But it was too late to fix that now. Thanks for letting me know, Helen said in an even tone, and Ben promised to call her back. She turned to talk to Jason when she hung up. We have two passengers in business who could be a problem. They're checking them out, and they'll tell us when they know more. What kind of problem? Jason was suddenly alert. He wondered why they had called her on the SATCOM phone, and was suspicious it might be something about him. He'd had his share of clashes with the airline, and they had slowed down his progress toward promotion considerably, but she didn't mention that, and seemed unaware of it. Apparently, the two passengers in question have an Arab name, but they don't show up on the lists, so they may be fine. That's all I know for now. I'd like you to take a stroll back through the cabins, and quietly let the crew know discreetly, she emphasized. Ask the business flight attendants to keep an eye on them, and let us know if they notice anything unusual about them or anyone. And if they do? Then what? Jason asked her pointedly. That was going to be a serious issue, especially with no air marshal on board, but Jason didn't know that. We'll figure it out, she said, seeming unworried. Jason left the cockpit a few minutes later to carry out his mission, and Connor looked at her. Is there a bigger issue than that? He asked. And she hesitated and shook her head. He wasn't part of the crew on this flight, and she didn't want to share the details with him. It might turn out to be nothing. If there's anything you need me to do, let me know. I will, she said with a smile to reassure him. Don't worry. Just enjoy the flight. As soon as Jason got back, the door locked behind him automatically. Ben had suggested she keep the cockpit sterile and let no one in except the flight crew until they knew more, and she agreed with him. I think we'll skip lunch, gentlemen, until we know more about our passengers on this flight. She didn't want to take any chances. She looked remarkably calm and unconcerned as they rode on in silence after that. Ben hadn't said there was an actual threat to the flight. He had just superficially mentioned San Francisco. But Helen knew better than anyone that anything could happen in today's world, and it didn't have to be political. All it took was one dangerous person, determined to bring a plane down. And all they could do now was wait for Ben to call them with news from the CIA.
Chapter 5 They had the crew profiles in less than 3 minutes and passed them around. The airline personnel office had provided them immediately. Ben divided them into two stacks for the two flights as he read them. He was looking for danger signs, and Amanda scrutinized them minutely and read each one several times before putting them back on each stack. Ben kept going over the files of the three pilots on board the A321 again and again. Something wasn't working for him. They still didn't know if they had a problem, but if they did, It could have been one of the three pilots in the cockpit, a member of the cabin crew, or anyone on board. It sounded crazy even to him when he said it out loud. He remembered that Bernice was in the room then, and might have noticed something unusual about the people who went through security before the two flights. Everything seemed to be in order